Hello and welcome to the Reaction Podcast. I'm Max Mitchell, political reporter and podcast editor here at Reaction, standing in for Ian Martin. The Troubles in Northern Ireland's by far the bloodiest and longest war in modern British history, yet also the least understood. Over the 30-year conflict, more than 3,700 people were killed, almost 50,000 injured, and an estimated 10,000 men and women were imprisoned. In the late 60s, a civil rights movement was gathering pace, advocating for equal rights for the Catholic Irish nationalist minority and an end to the discrimination by the Protestant Unionist government and local authorities. In August 1969, protests in the Bogside area of Derry led to the deployment of British troops. They would remain there for another 38 years, with the last British troops finally handing power over to the local police in 2007, almost a decade after the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. With me today to talk about the Troubles, espionage and his new book, Four Shots in the Night, A True Story of Espionage, Murder and Justice in Northern Ireland, is Henry Hemming. Henry, welcome.
Thanks, Max. Really good to be here.
Can you explain to our listeners what your new book, Four Shots in the Night, is really all about?
Yeah, sure. I think if you strip away everything else, Four Shots in the Night is the story of a murder. And it's about the events leading up to it. And I don't just mean the few weeks and months. In some ways, I mean the centuries leading up to this particular killing. It's about the act itself, the question over who was responsible, and how the desire to find an answer to that question led far away from the site of this killing and had a profound influence on our understanding of the Troubles, but in particular, our understanding of the role played by undercover agents during this conflict.
Mm. And early in the book, you say that this conflict is the least understood in modern British history. Mm. Why do you say that?
I say that because there's a huge amount we don't know. And in many ways, there's a huge lack of desire to find out exactly what went on from people outside the region. And of course, within Northern Ireland, there is an enormous desire, especially from people, from the families of victims of paramilitary organisations during the Troubles. There's a huge understandable desire to find out what happened. But when you get to Great Britain, there's less. And I suppose the next question is why? Why do we have this in Britain, this indifference towards Northern Ireland, or almost a desire to look the other way? And in some ways, it's a historical thing. So for many years in Parliament, if a question came up about Northern Ireland, it would immediately be deferred. It wouldn't be discussed or debated. It was seen as something that needed to be talked about elsewhere. But I think there's also an emotional element. I think there's some form of shame or embarrassment, a feeling that what's going on there isn't quite right. We don't really understand it. And I think the third thing to bring in is a degree of exceptionalism. The idea that what's happening in Northern Ireland is somehow exceptional and different. We don't really understand, and different rules apply. Therefore, let's not try to apply our own rules. And what's interesting about that is that in so many ways, UK law does often apply in Northern Ireland, and there should be much greater similarity, certainly in terms of how we think about Northern Ireland and life in the rest of the UK. So I'm interested in terms of where it comes from. I think maybe the last thing to say about this, and this is a much broader historical point, is whenever you have around the world a bitter domestic conflict such as the Troubles, there's a pretty clear pattern that emerges if there's no clear victor. And usually for the first 10 or 20, maybe 25 years, there's a reluctance to really look at what happened. And I think it's beginning to change now. I think we're obviously more than 25 years on from the end of the Troubles, and the Troubles mostly ended in 1998. And there are certainly more books coming out about what happened. There are more films. I think we've reached a point where journalism morphs into history. We're sort of crossing over into a stage where historians can really get their teeth into the subject. More is becoming known. And we have a little bit of distance. We can try and figure out what really happened.
Yeah, and that's always necessary with any historical analysis, isn't it? A little bit of distance.
Yeah.
You actually need that.
Yeah.
And so the epigraph of the book was something that I loved as a Louis McNeice fan.
Yeah.
The last stanza of his poem entirely. And I'll read it out for our listeners who haven't read that. And if the world were black or white entirely, and all the charts were plain, instead of a mad weir of tigerish water, a prism of delight and pain, we might be sure of where we wished to go, Or again, we might be merely bored, but in brute reality, there is no road that is right entirely. Apart from McNeice being a Belfast boy, why did you choose that? What does that tell us about the book that we're about to read?
I think the feeling underlying that stanza takes us to the moral heart of this book, of Four Shots in the Night. And there's something I touch on in the book, which I describe as the spymaster's dilemma. And this is a quandary which was faced by the people who are deciding what to do with intelligence in Northern Ireland. But it's also been faced by spymasters throughout the ages. Go back to ancient Rome, ancient Greece, you'll find people dealing with the same problem. And it comes down to one thing. Having received a piece of intelligence, are you going to save more lives by acting on it or indeed by not? And look, on the face of it, that sounds crazy. I mean, let's be more specific. Let's say you're an agent handler in Northern Ireland. You pass on information to one of your senior officers about someone in the IRA who's abducted someone and is soon going to be killing that person, as far as this person knows. So that's the information you have. And on the face of it, surely you need to act. You need to tell the police as soon as possible so they can intervene and try and save this man's life. But what makes it interesting, what makes it harder, is that as the person acting on that intelligence, there are a whole series of things that are actually getting in the way of you just calling in the police. Number one, it may be that the only reason you know that is because your agent has told you. And it could be that if the police go in, the agent will come under suspicion and will soon be killed. It can also be that the agent is wrong. So their information is rarely 100% accurate, rarely 100% complete. Another problem is that you don't have much time in which to make this decision. So often doing nothing will be the easiest option. And I guess the other thing to factor in, and this takes us to a much bigger question, you don't know how valuable your source is. You can't see into the future. You don't know whether this source is going to continue to give you fantastic, actionable intelligence for the next 5, 10 years, allowing you to save hundreds of lives, let's say. Or, for all you know, that agent might just pack up the following day and cease to provide information. So this leaves you with a moral quandary. You have to decide what to do. And to take us back to McNeice, you're in a situation where you've got two wrong answers. There is no obvious right answer. And so many times during the Troubles, you had handlers or the people dealing with this information who were facing these kinds of dilemmas.
This is something you can't really legislate for, this moral fudge, this quandary where there's no right answer. There's no way that you could properly legislate this.
Yeah, although, interestingly, there is now legislation which is trying to find a way of making this dilemma less problematic, less difficult. But certainly at the time that we're talking about, during the Troubles, there was simply no legislation covering whether an agent could take part in criminality and exactly what you should do as a handler in that kind of situation. And so what you had was a situation where many, many soldiers or policemen or MI5 operatives were handling these situations without necessary training, but also without the necessary legislation. So they didn't know what was lawful and what was not.
Right, right. And so on the specifics of Four Shots, we experience the story largely through the life of a man called Frank Hegarty. Who is Frank and how does he get involved in the IRA? What's his story?
Frank Hegarty is a man from Derry/Londonderry. He's a father of three. He's known as a good-natured, reliable family man. He's not the first person you'd think of as being a James Bond-esque spy. He's known to most of his friends in Derry as someone who's a greyhound man. He's much loved in the greyhound community. He trains greyhounds, is often crossing the border, taking dogs to a nearby racecourse. And that's his life when he's approached in 1980 by first MI5, but then the agent recruiting unit within the army. And they successfully recruit him. And maybe I'll keep my powder dry as to exactly how they do that. I'll leave that for the book. But it's a fascinating story. And I think the kind of the standout detail is just how much time and effort goes into this one recruitment, how much thought, how many people are involved. And as I say, he's not an obvious candidate, but you begin to understand as the story unravels what they see in him. And then after 3 or 4 years of working as an agent, being run by the army, but actually being on the books at MI5, you see his life change and he's asked to join the IRA.
Mm.
And that's when everything shifts. That's when we move into a different gear. The stakes are raised.
Mm.
He's working with the quartermaster in the local IRA brigade in Derry. And very soon, he's asked by Martin McGuinness to look after a series of weapons hides just over the border. So a hide, in this context, is just a place where you hide weapons and arms and explosives. And Frank Hegarty is put in charge of this enormous shipment of arms that have come from Libya. So Gaddafi is beginning to fund the IRA, and this is just one of 4 enormous shipments that comes through. So Hegarty is looking after them, and he then makes the decision to tell his handler about the location of these weapons. And that's when the story takes a turn.
Yeah, it's an incredible story, and we will leave the details for the book. We're going to have to toe this line for our whole conversation. What should we divulge, much like the spies? But explain a little bit about what the British intelligence services looked like early in the Troubles and how that developed. What services were there and what was the structure and what was the hierarchy like?
It's a really interesting narrative. I mean, I suppose the difference between British intelligence at the very start of the Troubles compared to the picture right at the end, and they're like chalk and cheese. At the start of the Troubles, MI5 has a desk with just 2 officers working on Northern Ireland, that's it. And at that time, the security service sees Northern Ireland as just something which doesn't really concern them. Yes, the Troubles is going on, but as far as they're concerned, it's a security issue, something that should be dealt with by the military and by the police. And it takes them the best part of 10 years to really change that attitude and to get to a stage where they think, actually, intelligence can help to change the outcome of the Troubles. And so what are we looking at? We're looking at 3 main agencies. We've got MI5, which I've just mentioned. We've got the army, which around about the same time that MI5 begins to focus more on Northern Ireland, so this is the late 1970s, the army develops something called the FRU, F-R-U, Force Research Unit. And this is a really interesting development. This is the first time that the army has this semi-autonomous, focused unit, which is simply dedicated to recruiting and running undercover agents. And they begin to do so with more expertise. They become better at doing this. Now, the criticism of them that comes in later is that they became a law unto themselves. I don't think that's totally true, but there's an element of truth in that. And the third agency is the police, its special branch. And they're actually running more agents than anyone else in Northern Ireland. And what's interesting is that these 3 different organisations, they've all got slightly different focuses. MI5, mostly interested in the political, strategic intelligence. They want people inside Sinn Féin or close to it. Or they want to know about the movements in the upper echelons of the IRA. They want to know what Gerry Adams is thinking, who he's talking to, or who's looking to take over. And the army, meanwhile, they're much more interested in tactical intelligence. They want to know where a bomb's going to be planted, where an attack is about to take place. And I said that at the beginning of the Troubles, this intelligence operation was threadbare, tiny, unsophisticated. It grew and grew. It became more sophisticated. And I'll finish by talking about the size of it later on. There's an astonishing moment in a recent BBC programme where they interviewed somebody called Father Dennis Bradley. And he's a guy who was on the consultative group on the past. And in that capacity, he was shown classified government documents, which gave him an idea of just how many agents were being run in Northern Ireland during the Troubles at any one time. And the number he came up with is astonishing. He said there were 800 undercover agents at any one time. And then later on in the same programme, the interviewers put this number to a former intelligence professional. And he said, actually, that's an underestimate.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about a huge operation, a lot of agents, a much larger support staff of handlers and drivers and people assessing this information and collating it. And I suppose the next question you could ask is, did this have an impact?
Mm.
Did it change the course of the Troubles? And I would argue that, yes, it did, subtly, but it certainly brought forward the end.
Yes, because it feels like people describe the Troubles as a low-level war that was lingering, hence why it went on for so long. And, I mean, you can try and argue that to people who lived and breathed it, but people from the outside say, well, it wasn't like world war chaos. It wasn't Dresden. It wasn't completely flattened. But try living in it for 30 years. In the book, you describe really well the evolution of the IRA and how they come to understand it as an intelligence war and how their tactics shift and how... What is the split between the official IRA and the provisional IRA? Where does that split happen and why?
So it happens about 4 months into the Troubles. And by that I mean 4 months after British troops first are seen walking through the streets of Derry in Belfast. So the beginning of Operation Banner. And up until then, the IRA has been a fairly non-military organisation. It's got revolutionary ideals. It's got a very Marxist bent. It is absolutely set on uniting the working class in Northern Ireland, so getting Catholics and Protestants to come together. And only after that's happened, then you rise up as one to oust the Brits. And a small group of people broke away from this, the original IRA, in late 1969, early 1970, and they formed the Provisional IRA, which left the original one as the officials. And the Provisionals were absolutely committed to violence. They felt there's no time, we don't have time to hang around and try and wait for some political union of the working class. Ain't going to happen. We need to use military means. And Martin McGuinness, actually, someone I've mentioned, he began as a member of the officials, but very quickly moved over to the Provisionals. And soon the officials declared a ceasefire, and the Provisionals were left as the only show in town. And then if we're talking about the evolution, there is this big moment in the late 70s where the outlook of the Provisionals changes and they adopt something called the Long War Strategy. And essentially they become a smaller, leaner, more professional organisation. And I watch a lot of football. I find I'm often really tempted to use football analogies for almost every situation. My editors always say, like, we only one per book. So the one football analogy I have in this book is for the IRA going for the Long War Strategy. And essentially it's choosing not to go all out for a victory. You're playing for a draw. So you're realizing that if we can really sit this one out, if we can survive as an organization, then we stand a much, much better chance of achieving our political goals.
10 men behind the ball.
Basically.
Yes. And so Martin McGuinness, as a young man in Derry, he's part of the official IRA and then is overcome with this military enthusiasm. How does the British intelligence service view Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams, the leadership of the Provisional IRA? What is their tactic and towards those two, and how does that change?
From a really early stage, they are interested in Gerry Adams initially. They're not so interested in Martin McGuinness back in the early 1970s. So there's a fascinating moment when the IRA go to negotiate with the British government and with Willie Whitelaw, back in the early 70s. And the person who's in the plane with them as they fly over to London is Frank Steele. And he's an MI6 officer. He spent all of his career moving around parts of the British Empire. He befriended Kenyatta in Kenya and remained friends with him as he became leader of a newly independent Kenya. And this in some ways is straight out of the British intelligence playbook. In a situation like what you had in Northern Ireland, select leaders of the paramilitary opposition who you think you can work with, who you think have the potential one day to be political leaders. And Frank Steele is there essentially kind of trying to work out which amongst these senior IRA men has that potential. And he alights immediately on Gerry Adams. He thinks Gerry Adams has huge intelligence, charisma and long-sightedness. And he's fairly interested in Martin McGuinness, but not so much. And fast forward about 8 years, and McGuinness has become more powerful, and he's increasingly seen by the British as someone who really does have the potential to lead the IRA towards peace. And there's an amazing minute, which I found in the National Archives, which is the most senior MI5 guy in Northern Ireland writing to Margaret Thatcher in 1981. And he talks about how the likes of McGuinness and Adams are ones who should be encouraged towards a political solution. And that word encouraged is doing a lot of heavy lifting, and that's really interesting. He's never in a minute going to spell out how they're going to be encouraged. But that's one of the first times you have it down on paper as British intelligence saying, actually, let's see what we can do to limit their military options and to make the political ones more attractive. And in terms of, you know, their assessment is these guys have the potential to be political leaders, but what do they do with that information? One of the things they do, which is interesting, is on at least four occasions, they save both men's lives. So there's, for example, an attempt by Protestant paramilitary extremists on Gerry Adams' life in the mid-1980s. This is uncorroborated, but I've heard it quite a few times from some semi-reliable sources. But the story is that the British knew about this, and they were able to tamper with the weapons that were going to be used in this attack. And in the report of the attack, sure enough, there were two gunmen who fired a series of bullets into Gerry Adams from about 15 metres away. He ended up with four bullets inside him. And I still remember reading the account by the surgeon who treated Adams, saying he really wasn't very close to death at all. And you think with four bullets fired into you from really not very far away, you'd probably be dead. So that was almost certainly the first occasion in which they saved his life. But there are other occasions where it's more easy to confirm what happened. So that's one of the things they did to preserve their leadership.
Mm. I think it's so interesting that political shift that the British intelligence services said, well, if the IRA are going to play the long war, so will we, and we'll try and encourage them to adopt some sort of political role here. I find that fascinating, and so many of Margaret Thatcher's voters would have hated this idea. They really would have loathed the idea that there was some covert, soft diplomacy going on at all. What was Margaret Thatcher's relationship like with Ireland?
That's a great question. Every time I've seen it described, she comes across as just feeling impatient and bored by the subject of Northern Ireland, and indeed Ireland. I think it's fair to say she didn't have an understanding of Irish history comparable to some other civil servants around her or other politicians. And there's an amazing account by one of her civil servants of a conversation he remembered having with Thatcher mid-80s. And they're trying to work out what to do in Northern Ireland. And Thatcher, as this memoirist recalled, said something like, wasn't there a time when someone brought about a population transfer? And one of her aides said, do you mean Cromwell? She said, yes, that's the one. Couldn't we try that? Which is just an astonishing moment. I mean, first of all, the kind of like slight uncertainty as to who it was, but then even just suggesting it. I mean, you're proposing ethnic cleansing.
Yes.
And as this guy then very sort of delicately put it, this proposal was not brought forward.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wise
so
choice.
I don't think she understood it. I don't think she enjoyed talking about the subject. It frustrated her. And I think there was also, this is to do with her relationship with history in the Second World War. She had this deep-seated resentment towards the Irish for their position during the Second World War and still resented what went on.
Right, and their neutrality.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So a large focus of the book naturally is Operation Canova. And could you explain a bit about what that is and what its processes were without, you know, giving too much away? History having happened.
I'll stop being coy. Happy to give away lots. It's Operation Canova. And to understand that, you need to understand State Knife. State Knife is an agent. He's an agent who was taken on by the British Army back in the late 1970s. And just to cut to the chase, he's someone who then joined the IRA, ended up inside something called the Nutting Squad. And this is the unit devoted to hunting down, interrogating, and then if the order came from up on high, killing suspected informers. So this agent, State Knife, whose real name is Freddie Scapaticci, that's what he was involved in. And we don't know how many murders he took part in, if he ever pulled the trigger himself. Nutting Squad contained about 12 people at any one time. We certainly know about attempts that were made by his handlers to make sure that he could not take part in some of these murders. But it seems pretty clear that he was involved in at least some of them. Mm. He was part of this. This was set to remain a closely guarded secret until one man, a soldier, somebody called Ian Hurst, went to the Sunday Times. He went to the Sunday Times just after the Good Friday Agreement. And he said there was an agent called State Knife and he was part of the Nutting Squad. So suddenly this became a story. And State Knife was then named a few years later. And about 12 years after that, something called Operation Canova began. And this is just a criminal investigation into State Knife. And it was an attempt to get State Knife in court and to then have him prosecuted and to have him put behind bars. I think some people, when they think about this, imagine it's an inquiry or something like that. It was not. It was a team of 72 detectives. They conducted 336 interviews, saw 12,000 classified government papers, and they were absolutely set on getting him in jail. Mm. And in some ways, they were defeated by the fact that Scappaticci died just before a decision was reached. And I know that the man behind this Operation Canova, John Boucher, remains really angry about this, about the delays in the decision, because they submitted their case files before Scappaticci died. They submitted it to the PPS in Belfast. And the people on Canova were convinced that these files were good enough, that they were, I think one person went on record as saying, we're 100% sure there's enough, that we've passed the evidential bar. And the PPS delayed and delayed and delayed. And there were law changes, which began to be put in motion, which would mean that Scappaticci might never actually end up in court, even if PPS decided he needed to. So, I mean, there's a really interesting story here, which maybe can't be told for now. Maybe 10, 20 years from now will be told. But I think there were certainly there were efforts to keep Scappaticci out of court. Mm. And what I've heard is that one of the reasons for this might have been that Scappaticci had said, if I go in court, I'm bringing everyone down with me.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
You can imagine that.
Yeah.
And so do you think that Operation Canova was a failure?
I don't. Mm. And the reason for that is what's happening right now, actually, as we're talking almost. The man behind it, John Boucher, has always said there are two parts to this. One is criminal prosecution. The other is getting truth to the victims' families. And what Canova has begun to do is deliver bespoke individual reports to each of the, I think it's about 26 families, who believe that their loved one might have been killed by Scappaticci. And they've begun to do this. So that's a document, sometimes running up to 100 pages, giving as much information as possible, describing what probably happened to their loved one. And this is really interesting. Boucher has gone on the record many times saying that a lot of these families, they're less interested in the idea of criminal justice. They're much more interested in getting the truth, or at least a version of it. And I think that only makes sense in terms of just the extraordinary lack of information that they had. And most of the time, and this is to do with the stigma attached to having a loved one who was working as a spy, most of the time these families, they weren't even approached by the police after their loved one had been killed. Such was his sense of, well, it's a spy that's been killed, so it doesn't really count.
Wow.
And so for them, just having some clear understanding of what their loved one went through matters more than anything else in many cases.
I think they've probably waved goodbye to justice a long time ago.
Yeah.
And I think truth is as close as they will get to some sort of something equivalent to justice in their own mind or closure for them. It seems to be quite common to hear that the IRA was on the ropes when the Good Friday Agreement was passed. Is that true?
It is true.
Yeah.
And I think you could say that from the early 1990s.
Really? As early as that?
There was a really interesting interview with somebody called Brendan Hughes, and he was talking about the state of the IRA in Belfast and Derry by the early 1990s. And he was saying that 9 out of 10 operations have been called off, that had become a hall of mirrors. You, as an IRA volunteer, you just did not know who to trust, who could be a spy, who might not be. Now, it was a different situation down in South Armagh and some of the more rural units. They were much more secure. They hadn't been penetrated to the same extent. But certainly in the major urban centres, most of these units had been penetrated, and there was extremely good intelligence coverage. So yes, the IRA was on the ropes, but it wasn't defeated. And with an organization like that, you only need a handful of units to keep going. And I think it may have been on the ropes, but it could have still kept going for a long time.
Right. And Irish unification is still very much a live debate in modern Northern Ireland and in the Republic. As recently as February, the president of Sinn Féin, Mary Lou MacDonald, said that a referendum on unifying Ireland and Northern Ireland would happen within the next 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
It's a fascinating subject. I mean, the thing I always think of is there's different ways of saying yes. You can have a hard yes and a soft yes. Hard no, soft no. And I think maybe the way into it is that if it were to be a yes, it'd be more of a soft yes, whereas 40 years ago it would have been a hard yes for people who voted yes. In other words, for a lot of young people in Northern Ireland today, the issue is just much less emotive. It means a lot less than it did back in the 1980s or the 1990s for their parents or their grandparents. And I think there are two other really, really big shifts. And the first is the fact that the Catholic Church in Ireland has a very different reputation and power compared to the situation in the 80s. So that reduces the fear that was felt by a lot of Protestants in Northern Ireland, their fear that they were going to be joining this religious state. And the change in the status of the church has really altered that. And I think the other thing that's worth bringing in is just underlying the Troubles, at the very beginning of it, you have a civil rights movement, and that's designed to end, as you said in the introduction, discrimination against Catholics in Northern Ireland. And I'd be naive to say there is no longer any discrimination, but there's a lot less. And I think that underlying cause of the Troubles, which is also an underlying desire to bring about unification, has reduced. It's had the edge taken off. So there's less desire for unification, but it could still quite easily happen.
Henry Hemming, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Henry's new book, Four Shots in the Night, is out now. Until next time, thank you for listening.